And this guy, the Drew, was hated by his fellow Druze. He was said to be an informer, Malshin. And in fact, in 1290, he was assassinated by a Drew. People stopped coming to Shul because they had nowhere to sit and the rent was too exorbitant.
That's quite a loaded question. In this particular halacha, again, a shul has a right to say we'd rather not accept this gift and try diplomatically. And then circumstances over time can change. Sometimes there can be a machlokes, a power struggle, a split. And sometimes it comes down to who are the holding trustees, because they may well be muhsik in the charity, the building, the trust.
Stolen by the Christians, converted into a church, and the Spanish authorities to this day refuse point blank to give it back. But you walk in there and you see psukim all along the walls.
Welcome to History for the Curious. I'm Menno Reisner, and I host the internationally renowned lecturer, dynamic historian, and tour guide, Rabbi Aubrey Hirsch. Experience our history, confront dilemmas, and reveal the untold stories of 3,000 years of Jewish heritage. From Paris to Cairo, from the Russian Tsar to Maimonides, and from the Sinai Revelation to the French Revolution. Join the fastest-growing Jewish history podcast in the world by subscribing to this channel and discovering the events that have shaped us into who we are today. Rabbi Hirsch, welcome to part two of Responsa in Halacha and History. And this week we have the honor of having Dain Yeshua Pozon of the Federation presenting later on during the podcast. Thank you again to Dain Hul for last week's recording. In terms of trips, moving on from Pesach, although I'm assuming most people are knee-deep in their Pesach preparations, but just possibly to put in their calendars, the Vienna, Bratislava, and Nikolsburg trip in May with Rabbi Tetz and Rabbi Hirsch is now sold out. But there is a second one with the exact same itinerary, which will be taking place on the 15th to the 18th of July. You can expect to visit historic shuls, old Bote Kvoros, palaces, or be guided by Rabbi Hirsch, and there will be talks from Rabbi Tetz. You'll be staying in a five-star accommodation with very high-end catering. If this is of interest, please email gianna.elav@gmail.com. We'll put the email address in the description below. There are only 35 spaces available, so even though you're distracted now, you might as well email in just to ensure that you have a preliminary spot on the trip. Rabbi Hirsch, onto the podcast.
Thank you. So, shul politics looms very large in Responsa, and we will focus particularly on Spain, not because they're more guilty of it than the Ashkenazim, but because of the volume of tshuvas from the Rashbar on the topic, often due to the circumstances in which they found themselves, because for much of the period of the Rishonim, especially the 12th and the 13th centuries, Jews in northern Spain are under Christian rule, and in the south they're under Muslim rule. And then you have the Christian reconquest, so towns are changing hands. In fact, we hope to do a full series on Spanish Jewry after Pesach, Yet Hashem.
Please reach out for sponsorships.
Yes, that's true. Absolutely. Now, Spain was home to Jewish communities for many centuries. In fact, the oldest remains of a synagogue in Spain date somewhere between the 5th and 6th century in the southeast near Valencia, although only five complete buildings survived through the centuries, and only because they were basically stolen from the Jews and taken over and turned into churches. So the laws of Christianity in the Middle Ages forbade the construction of new synagogues, although Jews still managed to occasionally get away with it or persuade the authorities otherwise, to the extent that even after the doomed disputation in Barcelona in 1263, the king allowed the Jews to build a shul nearby, which also was converted into a church, this time in August 1391, and was located inside the Jewish quarter. But, and this is the big but, building new was one thing, repairing and enlarging quite another, and this was pretty much a no-no. And from 1247 onwards, the Dominicans were allowed to preach in the synagogues, and they would come with their hordes on Shabbos. They would do damage to the synagogues, and repair was something that became a necessity, and it was not easily done. In fact, often illegal or just forbidden outright. Shuls also needed to be solidly constructed for other more unfortunate reasons. In times of danger, the shul served as refuge, as shelter from the anti-Jewish mobs. In fact, we find from Rabbi Yoel Sirkus, the Bach, here in Poland, in the year 1606, he writes, Tikkun godol l'chol hakol, it would be of great benefit to everyone, livnois bevinyan avonim be'emta hachotza, to build a shelter using stones in the centre of the shul courtyard, ve'efsha bezeh hatzola al kol tzora, which will save the community from tzoras that arise. Now, in general, back then, the shul wasn't just a place that you came to daven. Everything happened there. It is the focal point of all religious, social, political, cultural life. And I don't just mean that they talked about all those things in the middle of davening, but it was actually what you might call a much broader Beis HaKnesses, a house of assembly.
Which you still see sometimes today in various parts of Europe, like communal center is the main shul.
But generally there is a building which has grown out of just being a shul, so they've put other things in there. They might have the communal restaurant.
Wasn't originally constructed.
Right, yeah. Right. And all announcements of importance are proclaimed in the synagogue, all bans, any oaths were taken in front of the Oron Kodesh, and personal events, weddings, hespedim of the Leviah itself. And in some places, the shul served as a place of lodging for itinerants. And there we find a comment in the Truvas that the synagogue gates had to be closed at times due to the amount of people that were often taking advantage of the shul because of that. And then when it comes to raising money for taxes, internal, governmental, it all happened there. And the heads of the community are empowered to collect these donations by force if necessary. The shul is also the place where the Jewish community is informed of their general responsibilities and duties, because the king would have his orders read out in the shul. And on occasion, the shul is even used as a sort of temporary prison, a house of arrest by non-Jewish authorities, based on the above. If a Jew or a number of Jews would fail to pay their taxes, they could be moved into the shul. The shul is now closed down, and in its stead, there's a sort of a quasi-prison functioning there, which also touches now on historic occurrences, putting people in cherem, excommunicating them. There is a tshuva from the Rashba. There's an individual who's been placed under ban. And the question is, can he join as part of the 10 people to form a minyan? To which the answer from the Rashba is no. But then he adds, that doesn't exempt him from coming to shul to daven. And he says, Aval shaloi lehispalel b'tzibur, not to pray in the shul at all, k'moy sh'ra'isi sh'nogu kein, as I've seen people being lenient about, eini yodea bo shum ikar. I can't understand how they can justify it. And he's writing about it as I've seen done. So clearly, this excommunication was far from an extreme case. It happened. Imagine nowadays if someone was put into cherem, you know, coming in, he wouldn't come to shul in the first place. Bearing in mind that under cherem, no one is allowed to greet you, no one is allowed to stand within 6 foot of you, so, you know, what's the likelihood of him bothering to get out of bed in the morning to turn up? But the Rashba says there's absolutely no excuse, and that, I guess, puts excuses that other people use today into insignificance. And you find in towns like Kolin in Bohemia that they had special sort of chambers for people under ban who were nevertheless coming to shul to daven. Which
overtook the Ezras Noshim, probably.
You have to know that in a number of these shuls, they didn't have an Ezras Noshim, as women never really came to shul. The functions of running a household, if you think today to what degree electricity has had an impact, you know, ironing, cooking, all of these things took so much time. Getting water from the well, all of these things, they rarely came to shul, and therefore, other than the main synagogue, the smaller ones didn't have an Ezra's Nashram in the first place.
Was it the woman's job to get water from the well?
Not necessarily, but she would be doing the washing by the, wherever, the water.
Right, the river. Fascinating. So you see that in Europe, that there's no, I'm just trying to think
well,
about
the Altnoy Shul is a classic example, because everyone goes there and is horrified by the fact that the women's section is a full wall of a meter away from the main shul. And that's because it was an addition. It wasn't part of what was there in the first place. So back to shuls. Now, all listeners post-COVID are no doubt aware of the fact that there is a dispute in halacha as to whether one can have a minyan of 10 men who are split over two or more gardens, you know, five in one, five in the other, because they're two separate domains, even if they can hear each other. This is not a 21st century debate. The Rishonim deal with it, but for very different reasons. The Rashba is responding to basically changing fortunes for the Jews. And it was the case that some Jews had no seats in shul. They prayed in the courtyard because it was seen as an extension. And therefore the question is, are they part of the minyan? So he says, you know, if there are already 10 men indoors, there's a minyan there, then the ones outside can join. And otherwise it gets complicated. It depends on walls and sight lines and whatever. And in fact, this brings up the fact that it's not just shuls that are central to Jewish existence in the Middle Ages, but seats in the shuls are hot property, so to speak, especially if you can't enlarge the shul. The seating reflected your social or economic status in the kehillah, so you get the wealthier sitting close to the front row near Mizrach, near the eastern wall, or near the rabbi, and the poor sat at the back.
So you could only sit down in the shul if you actually owned a seat?
More or less. I mean, the Bach actually writes, this is in Urachaim, not in Truvus, Kol shken mi she'en lo mokoim klal, somebody who does not have a seat there at all, v'tzorich lamoid b'chatzar beis haknesses, and therefore is forced to daven by standing, not just standing during davening, but standing outside in the courtyard. Now, you didn't have to own a seat. Shul seats could be rented out to those who couldn't afford to buy one on a permanent basis. So, I don't know, if you were making a wedding and you wanted to be inside for davening when the chosan is given his aliyah.
To a short-term rental.
Basically, yes. And we find the opposite. There's a truva that deals with the case of a Jew who sells his seat in shul because he's in need of cash to provide for his daughter's wedding.
Right.
You know, seats in shul were a real investment, not just somewhere you happen to turn up to for shacharis.
Although that is pretty commonplace, I think, nowadays, when especially when a shul invests a lot and builds a, completely refurbishes or builds a new shul, the seats are sold.
Seats, plural, meaning you buy a seat. And where do you actually end up sitting?
Wherever the gabba decides.
Yeah, or where it's convenient, or where it's near a window, or under the air conditioning, or whatever it is. But you don't have a social strata of seats, and no one puts that much emphasis on it. It's not that a big deal.
Right.
And you find, for instance, in Prague, when the Tosus Yontov, who's the rabbi, is arrested as a result of a libel and given an enormous fine, he sold his seat in the Altnoy Shul to pay for it, to pay for part of it, which is why, by the way, if you go there, you'll find various seats at the front of the shul next to one another, because the rabbi wasn't in one particular location. And, you know, seats loom large in bygone periods. Now, the Rivosh, therefore, writes a case where a wealthy guy in town bought a number of seats as an investment, speculation. And when the price of seats went up, he rented them out, but he raised the price of the rent. Okay, listen to this. People stopped coming to shul because they had nowhere to sit, and the rent was too exorbitant. So the community wrote to the Rivosh and said, can we put extra seats in the shul in the gangway? To which this wealthy person objects by saying that the access to his seat is being narrowed down as a result of these new seats. Does he have an argument or not? And the Rivosh says, yes, he does. Because not only do you own the seat, you own access to the seat. It's property.
Wow, it's real property.
Real property. So they said, okay, how about temporary chairs, mats, which people would sit on just for davening? And he said, no, These are public pathways. You can't encroach upon them. But he came up with some advice. He said the community is able to fix something. If they can force everyone in shul who has a spare seat to rent it out, and that makes greater availability, which means that the rabbonim at the time, when it came to these things, had to deal not just with halacha, but practical advice.
Well, and they can charge any amount and price out people? There weren't halachas about that?
I'm sure there would have been an amount, but actually, I don't know. That's a good question.
I'm also interested in, I mean, there are strict as literally owning a piece of real estate, then doing an extension in a shul can decrease the value of the seat as well.
We'll get there soon. Now, perhaps to answer your question somewhat, the first question, in the Vavad Arba Rotzis in Zolkiev in 1626, not only do they decide the price for different seats in shul, depending on where they are, but even the size of the shtender that people can bring to shul because it encroaches on the pathway. So I guess if prices went outside of the norm, they could complain, but you needed something like the Vada Barotis to be able to control it. Otherwise, maybe they could charge whatever they wanted to. And the Rush Boys asked another question about something which is called Bar Metzra, which means as follows. If I own a field or a house, and I have a next-door neighbor who's Jewish, and I'm selling my field or house, I have to give the rights of first refusal to my Jewish neighbor at market value. I don't have to discount it, but I have to give them first rights because they stand to gain the most by adding this property to their existing one. What about a seat in shul? Does this also constitute bar metzra? The Rush Boss says no, because the whole idea behind buying the field next door yours is that you can plough them in one go. So you've got economies of scale. Whereas if you've got two completely separate seats, it might be advantageous because, I don't know, you can put your son-in-law sitting next to you or your teenage son so you can keep an eye on him, but they are separate seats and therefore you've got no greater claim to it than anybody else.
But nowadays, bar metzra is very relevant to the house next door you. Is that for the same reason
yes.
that you can extend to it?
Yes, you can move, you can do something, or even if it's the gardens and the associated areas, yeah. So they asked another question. There were five seats on this bench. There were only four people there. They decided to buy the fifth one and enlarge each seat so that this bench, which originally accommodated five, would now only accommodate four. Is that bar metzra? I mean, I'm not sure if any of the listeners have visited the synagogue in Paris, the Rue de la Victoire, where left-hand side towards the front, you have one bench which does not have any armrests, unlike the rest of the shul, because that's where the Rothschild brothers sit, and they are officially completely unified, there are no divisions between them. Anyway, the Rashba answered the question by saying, Lo nireli, it does not appear to me that this is bar metzra.
Fascinating. Never heard of this concept at all. But if the way you're describing it is literal real estate,
yes,
then it might be a silly question, but were non-Jews ever able to buy, and could they sort of force their way in, seeing that it's publicly traded?
It's not that they could force their way in, but for instance, if somebody had debts and they would seize their property, so yes, they would end up owning seats in shul. In fact, at one stage, the king owned seats in a particular shul in Spain, and he had a favorite by the name of David Mascara, to whom he awarded this seat. And in this document, it even names the two people located on either side. And this guy, the Jew, was hated by his fellow Jews. He was said to be an informer, Malshin. And in fact, in 1290, he was assassinated by a Jew because an informer who puts Jews in danger can, under many circumstances, actually be put to death. And he's given this seat. And within the shul, there's basically nothing the Jews could do because it's property. They have to live with it. And if the king owns a seat, you know, let's just hope he doesn't turn up and want to give the drosha. And then you have seats given as an inheritance. So it's, I don't know, let's say it end up being divided amongst three people. Now what do you do? Or men who own seats in the women's section, women in the men's section, they can't use it. And these are all halachic question based on how shuls were viewed back then in history. The Rashba also deals, and this comes back to your second question earlier, with the question of somebody who wanted to donate the house next door the shul in order for the shul to be enlarged. And because the enlargement would only take place on the interior, they hoped that the Spanish authorities wouldn't find out that the shul has become suddenly bigger. In fact, if you go to Toledo, the Abulafia Synagogue, which was built in the 1350s, adjoined Abulafia's own house, which is probably or possibly the reason he got away with it. Once again, it was also stolen by the Christians, converted into a church, and the Spanish authorities to this day refuse point blank to give it back. But you walk in there and you see psukim all along the walls, including, quite ironically, the posuk Ashrei Yeshvei Veisecho, those that live in your house, as in God's house. Not quite. Anyway, back to the question. So the community is being offered a house free to enlarge the shul. And you'd assume that any community would jump at this chance. Not this one. Because the house was to the east, to the Mizrach, where they faced. And there was a complaint raised by some of those who were currently seated at the Mizrach Vant, at the very front adjacent to the Ark, that if you now enlarge the shul, first of all, the new shape wouldn't be exactly the same width, etc., etc., and therefore some of these people who had been sitting at the front wouldn't be anymore, and the more prestigious seats would lose out, so they objected to the expansion. So if you think you've got problems with planning permission from Barnet Council, you deal with this one. So the Rashbar comes up with a sort of a solution, the best that he can do. He says, listen, take the next door neighbor's house, make it into part of the shul, but that entire new house should function as part of the Oron Kodesh and its sort of associated requirements. No seats should be placed there, and that way there won't be any machlokas. And a final historic question on seats that came the Rashbar's way. So there's a bloke sitting in his seat, and somebody comes up to him and says, oi, this is my seat. And the guy sitting there says, yeah, it is your seat, but I've been sitting here for 3 years because you borrowed money off me, and the seat is a pledge to ensure repayment of the loan. So Shimon says, but I never borrowed any money off you. So this is where we need to come to Bava Basra, a thing called migui, which means as follows. If I make a weak argument in Beis Din, and I could have made a stronger argument to prove my case, and then I would have won, then my weaker argument is automatically accepted, because why didn't I just use the stronger argument and be done with it? In this case, the obvious stronger argument is, I've been sitting here for 3 years. What are you talking about? It's your seat. It must be mine. The assumption is, in halacha, that it's his, barring, you know, very extenuating circumstances. So he could just have said, you think it's your seat? It's mine. That would have been the end of it. But he presented a weaker argument. He said, it is your seat, but you owe me money. So they asked the Rashbar. Now, to complicate matters, while this dispute was ongoing, the guy who'd been sitting in the seat died. So Shimon now has to turn focus to the inheritors of the estate, the children who clearly know nothing about what happened 3-4 years ago. Says the Rashbar, the migu works. The guy sitting there, or now his inheritors, either they get paid or they keep the seat. And normally speaking, the guy sitting there would have had to take an oath to cement his claim to the seat. But since he has died, and since the children can't take the oath because they have no idea what happened, we award ownership to the children without further delay.
Fascinating. I thought that you're talking about Chazaka, I'm assuming, yes, with the 3 years. Yes. So you have the Rashbar responding to questions from all over Spain.
Yes, he has thousands of responsa, although sometimes the Rashbar doesn't answer. There's one particular responsum where he writes, you seem to be changing the story between one letter and the next. I'm going to wait until there's an agreed upon narrative, because I'm not going to weary myself, is the term he uses, by answering a question to an answer which might not be correct due to the fact that you haven't given me all the details.
Right, I suppose that was a problem with responsa in general. How much can nowadays one could pick up the phone and we have better communication? But then some people now to express themselves by letter and some don't, and it's always a problem.
I have to tell you the same problem exists over the phone as well. If somebody has worded it in such a way that you assume, and everybody would assume something, you know, the more astute and the more experienced a Rav is, the more they will make sure that they're answering the right question. But I close this section with my favourite responsum of the Rashbar in Volume 1 of his Truvas. And he is asked as follows. For those people who carry on talking while the Torah is being read, Omarta al-Mahim Semchim, you want to know, What are they relying upon that they, you know, continue chatting in shul? And the Rashba answers, I have to tell you, it beats me. I've got no idea. I can't find an excuse for them talking in shul. Unless, he says, they're discussing words of Torah, and even that is not obvious, except for people who are committed to Torah study, like Rav Sheshes, who was one of the sages of the Talmud. But the interesting thing here is that the question was asked in the first place as if it's, you know, sort of debatable, unless it's somebody asking because they wanted to make a point because the talking had gotten out of hand. But either way, I guess it does reveal that these things are happening in shul 600-700 years ago as well.
Was the question asked specifically because talking while the Torah is being read is the most stringent time?
And in some ways, it's not as stringent as, for instance, during the repetition or right. So. No, I don't think because of that. Maybe that was just what was going on.
All right.
And finally for this week, a facet of shuls that you would never associate with halacha. How surrounding non-Jewish culture can influence, and I don't mean in a negative way, customs in shuls, where intuitively you'd think, well, whatever the non-Jews do, we surely should be doing the opposite inside our houses of worship and tefillah. And this is a truva written to Shlomo Duran, the son of the Rashbats, as a congregation that wants to introduce a new rule forbidding anyone to enter the shul wearing shoes, because in Muslim eyes, wearing shoes in a house of worship is a disgrace. But some members oppose this new rule on the grounds that the Rambam allows you to wear shoes in shul. So he answers, everyone knows that a synagogue has to be treated with the utmost honour and respect, but honour and respect depends on what people regard as a mark of distinction and depends on local custom. In Christian lands, where wearing shoes is not a sign of disrespect, where you wear shoes even when you stand before the king, it's no disgrace to wear them in shul. In our Muslim lands, however, where it is an insult to wear shoes in the presence of dignity, certainly in the presence of the king, then you should not wear shoes in shul. And in Yemen, they would remove shoes before entering the shuls, certain killers in Morocco, and I'm told it's still the case on the island of Djerba in Tunisia. But the interesting thing is that at that same time, and today, in Ashkenazi shuls, it would be wrong to do that.
Really interesting. I mean, I suppose clothing is another example of something that Jews have adopted from the outside cultures as a form of respect, going from Hasidim wearing mastrimals, which were the nobleman's dress of back in the day. We do adopt customs from our surroundings.
But here he's actually making it a sort of a black and white scenario as to what you should be doing.
Wow. Rabbi Hirsch, thank you. So this has been mostly about individuals and shul. And now we turn to the issues of kehillah and shuls to Rabbi Posen, who has been involved in these issues for many, many years. And we see history of halacha being reflected in what communities do today, and especially what the definition and rights of a community are. We have the honor of welcoming to the studio Dayan Yeshua Posen. Dayan Posen has been a dayan for coming up to 20 years now. He's given over 1,000 shurim all over the world to a very large variety of audiences, subjects ranging to Chesha Mishpat, Shalom Bayis, education, dispute resolution, and many more. He specializes in partnership agreements, inheritance, estate planning, and is an accredited commercial and family mediator with many, many years of experience. Dayan Posen is also involved in Dine Torah, in Gittin and Kashrus, and is currently sitting on the Kehillas Federation based in. Dayan Posen, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. In law, there's a concept of a company being a separate legal entity and not just a partnership consisting of its shareholders. However, in numerous responses over the last century, it's been established, although in most cases, halacha recognizes the limited liability aspect of a company, it doesn't recognize a company as being a separate entity. Therefore, for example, one can't have one's company operating on Shabbos or only Chometz on Pesach and saying, it's not me, it's the company. I've heard it said before that maybe this is because in halacha, there never existed the concept of something being owned by an entity greater than the sum total of its individuals. But had such a concept existed, perhaps this too would have been accepted and applied when it comes to halacha's approach to companies as well. This is clearly incorrect. And one of the areas where one finds this is the matter I would like to discuss now, which is the concept of a kehillah, or community, particularly a communal beis haknesses, a synagogue. When a community comes together and acquires or builds a shul, around which the kehillah daven, have shurim, etc., The building is owned by the kehillah of that shul, which in turn is made up of its members. However, from responses spanning hundreds of years, it becomes clear that if, for example, we take a shul with 100 members, it's not the case that any given member owns 1% of the shul. Similarly, if the shul owns a building or asset worth, for example, £1 million, we would not say each member owns a share in the shul worth £10,000. There are various sources that prove this point, some going back to the Gemara, the Talmud, but I'd like to focus on one particular point where this fact has practical ramifications. In a responsa, the Reb Meir of Rottenburg, commonly referred to as the Maram Rottenburg, who lived in Germany in the 13th century, he quotes a responsa from a Reb Sholem Yitzchak, the son of Yehuda, in which he discusses the case of people in a town who came together to acquire a Sefer Torah. And they agreed between themselves, up front, that if one of them would move to another town, and therefore no longer benefit from this Sefer Torah, that when he leaves, he would get his portion. After a period of time, someone chose to leave town, but from the time the Sefer Torah had been acquired until this person decided to leave, the value of the Sefer Torah had increased. And the question now arose whether to pay him the money he had originally paid towards the cost of the Sefer Torah, or the increased current value his portion is now worth. Reb Sholem Yitzchak wrote in his response that it's clear that the Sefer Torah is to remain in the town and to continue to be used. So the only question is, how much money should be paid to the person leaving? Since it's unclear if the original agreement meant that the leaving party should be paid according to the money put in originally, or the value at the time of the exit. And since the person leaving can't prove either way which method is correct, we apply the famous rule, Hamoitzi Michaveri Olav Araya, i.e., one who wants to claim monies from another party, the onus of proof is on him to prove his claim. And therefore he's paid the lower amount, which in this case would be the original amount. It's pointed out that according to this approach, had the Sefer Torah depreciated in value, he would have received his share of the new, lower value. This ruling is codified in the Shulchan Aruch in Aruch Chaim Simon Kufnon Dalad Siv Tezvav. The Taz of David Halevi Siegel, the Abezin of Lvov in the 16th and 17th century, explains in his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch that the particular question only arose because initially it had been stipulated that on exit from the community, a person would be entitled to a payment. However, had that not been stated, notwithstanding the fact that each member may have contributed equally, if any were to leave, they would have no right to any payment. This is because the Sefer Torah was purchased for the people in this town. In this ruling, we see very clearly that where there is no prior stipulation, the Sefer Torah would be owned by the kehillah in the town, and the individuals that make up that community do not individually own a share in it per se. Therefore, if they were to leave the town, they are not entitled to a payment. David ben Sholem ibn Avi Zimra, commonly referred to as the Radvaz, who lived in the 15th and 16th century in Spain and then Egypt, and who wrote thousands of responsa, in his third volume in Shura Tof Ayin Beis, he quotes early authorities who have ruled that if there's a Beis HaKnesses in a town where everybody davens, it's forbidden for part of the community to split off and make a breakaway minyan. However, the Radvaz rules that if machlokes and division have formed in the community, and the breakaway will be in order to prevent the divisions and animosity from drastically increasing, then it's permitted to split off. The question which arises, which he doesn't deal with, is in such a scenario, when a kehillah splits, is each part of the kehillah entitled to take with them a share of the assets of the kehillah? The Mabit, Reb Moshe Mitroni, who lived in the 16th century in Sfas, discusses in Chelik Beis Siman Kufayin Aleph, a Beis HaKnesses which needed to be split. And when it came to dividing the assets, he ruled that if there are Sifrei Torah or silverware which were known to have been donated by a specific individual donor, and generally referred to as donated by that donor, for example, you may have the Kohen Sefer, then even though it belonged 100% to the kehillah, and not, as in most cases when it's initially only lent to the shul, it was to be given to the individual or their yerushim to be taken to where they daven now. If the items are no longer looked at as having been donated by a specific donor, then they are all to be divided according to how many men and boys over bar mitzvah will be davening in each of the two minyanim, i.e. split proportionally. In a fascinating twist, this response of the Mabit is quoted by Rav Avrom Abele Gombina from the 17th century in his famous commentary, the Mogen Avrom, on the halacha we quoted earlier in the Or HaChaim. And there, the Mogen Avrom brings a ruling which disagrees with the Mabit and says, when determining the percentage split of the Kehillah's assets, rather than just calculating how many men over 13 are in each camp, one has to also include how many women and children are in each camp. It would seem that the question of whether the size of the Kehillah is measured by how many males over bar mitzvah there are in each camp, or how many men, women, and children are in each camp, would revolve around whether a shul or a kehillah is based on the people who make up the actual minyan, or the members of households who are part of the kehillah. Nowadays, when it's common to find places where people daven in a particular shul out of convenience, but aren't actually members of that shul, and therefore their families may have nothing to do with that particular shul, would this change the defining factor of who we look at when calculating the numbers in each camp? If we return to the principal point in the Mabit, it was that the assets get split between the members' kehillahs. However, in a response a few hundred years later from Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Speck to the Av Bezin of Kovna in the 19th century, he ruled in Shuas Bei Yitzchak, in Or HaChaim Siman Kuf Chof Dalet, in a case where some members of a kehillah had left and opened up their own shul, and were now claiming their apportionment of the capital outlay, svarim, etc. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan ruled that they had left the kehillah and they're not entitled to take anything with them. The question is, how do you reconcile this ruling with that of the Mabit and the Mogen Avrom? Avrom Zvi Hirsch Eisenstadt, who happens to be my wife's great-great-grandfather, who lived in the 19th century and wrote his famous compendium, the Piskei Tshuva, in which he collates many relevant responsa, in his writings on Chesh Mishvot Sim Kuf Samar Gimel Sivov, he quotes both the Mogen Avrom and the Tshuvas Bei Yitzchak, and he explains that the two are talking about different circumstances and situations. If a kehillah outgrows its premises and therefore needs to split, then each section is entitled to receive the appropriate percentage of the kehillah's assets, as explained. However, if there's a fight, a machlokes, and part of a kehillah leave the rest, then the part that leave, if they are a minority of the community, are not entitled to take with them any of the kehillah assets. And in fact, if they've taken anything, he rules they need to return them. Rabbi Yosef Kairo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, who lived in the 15th and 16th century, in his response to Avachas Reichel, also seems to imply that he would rule the section who leave the kehillah have no right to anything if those who remain are the majority of the original community. However, Rabbi Shmuel ben Moshe de Medina, Marashtam, in a response in Siman Lamavov, written in the 16th century from Greece, disagrees and implies that even if the majority of the kehillah would leave the Beis HaKnesses and would go and daven elsewhere, as long as a minyan of men remain davening in the regular shul, then it's considered as if the shul remains, just that many members have left, but those who leave are not entitled to take anything with. It seems this argument revolves around if we determine that a kehillah is determined by the majority of the mespallelim members, wherever they may be, or is the kehillah deemed as being in its last official location until it officially moves? Rav Shlomo Shadron, the grandfather of Rav Shlomo Shadron, the Magid of Yerushalayim, who is in our generation, in his Sefer Das Torah, written in the end of the 19th century, brings both opinions and remains with a tzorach ion. He's unclear how to rule in such a case. In conclusion, we can see from the above responsa, which is only a tiny window into a specific point, how for the last 800 years at least, the responsa have debated to what extent the members of a kehillah have any rights to the assets of that kehillah. Notwithstanding such a concept, when it comes to a limited company, the poskim has still ruled that it's not viewed with regards to Shabbos and Chometz as being a separate entity. We also see a point which is relevant when trying to learn halacha from all responsa, that a subtle change in facts and reality from the case that the responsa was dealing with can result in the whole ruling changing drastically. If we allow ourselves to return to the response of the Mabit, you'll remember that he ruled, if a kehillah is splitting up, and as a result, the assets are apportioned, before doing so, if there is an item which is lo nishtaka shmoi, the name of the donor remains associated with it, then it's given to the donor or their yerushim to be used where they daven. This is very interesting because, for example, if a son were to buy, let's say, a silver becher for his father, or a daughter were to buy, let's say, a piece of expensive jewelry for her mother, and then, a number of years later, the parents pass That said becha or jewelry would form part of their estate and would be part of the pot that gets divided between the yerushim. And in the case of a daughter, depending on how he'd handled his estate or her estate, this could well result, al pi halacha, in it ending up by one of her brothers, and she wouldn't necessarily receive it. Yet when it comes to gifts donated to tzedakah, this seems to be different. It would seem that the reason for this is a special concept we find with regards to tzedakah. Rav Shlomo ben Avram ibn Aderes, commonly referred to as the Rashba, who lived in the 13th century in Barcelona and wrote thousands of responsa, writes in responsa Tov Kuf Pei Aleph on the topic of a person who donates to tzedakah. In this particular case, there was a gentleman who owned a building which adjourned the shul, the synagogue, and he knocked through to the shul and added his building to the existing Beis HaKnesses, and he wanted to have some form of plaque with his name on at the entrance to the part of the building which he had added to the shul. Rashba says that he's entitled to ask for this. And in fact, we find a similar concept in the Torah, that it's enshrined in the Torah certain praiseworthy acts as a legacy for the generations. Says the Rashba, we can learn from here that similarly, a person who makes a donation is entitled to have their name put up. The Rashba says it's an old established custom to do such a thing. This ruling is codified in the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch Yerideh, Siman Resh Mem Tes, Sifu Gimel, and the Ramah adds the words, V'ro'yu la'asis kein, it's befitting to do so. The Taz, in his commentary, suggests that perhaps the reason why the Ramah suggests it's befitting to do so is because of a halacha listed later in Shulchan Aruch, Siman Resh Mem Tes, Sifu Gimel, which also has its origins in a Rashba, which was quoted in the 15th century by Rabbi Yosef Konon ben Shlomo Trabato, the Marik. The Marik explains that if someone donated a menorah or other items to a Beis HaKnesses, as long as Ein Shtakesh Shmoy Me'aleo when it cries al Shmoy, as long as his name hasn't been disassociated with it and it's still called after him, then the community cannot downgrade it from its holy use. Explains the Taz, this is the reason for Ramah stating that it's befitting to have the name actually on or above the item which was donated, as then the donor's name will never be disassociated from that which they donated, and as a result, the community will not be able in the future to change from its intended purpose. There is a concept in halacha called tovus hanor, which is the right to distribute something which doesn't actually belong to the person doing the distribution. For example, if a person separates truma from their crops, even though they don't own it, they can decide which kohen to give it to. Similarly, when a person separates tzedakah, or even if they give it to a charity which still offers him the right to suggest where the tzedakah should be donated to, as is often the case nowadays, even though the money is now owned by the tzedakah, he has a right to distribute it, or an option to distribute it. This right is not viewed as a financial right, as the Shulchan Aruch puts it, Tovus Hanor in a Mammon. And as such, the Shulchan Aruch rules that this right will not pass to one's next of kin through the normal laws of inheritance, Yerusha. The rights of Tovus Hanor would normally be viewed as terminating once one has donated that money. And certainly, if one donated money to tzedakah and then died, based on halacha we just said, there would be no possibility of the Yerushim having any potential claim to reallocate the funds to a different tzedakah. Therefore, what the Mabit is talking about here is not the general rule of Tovus Hanor, the right to distribute, but a very specific right when a recognizable item has been donated and Lo Nishtakesh Shmoy, the legacy of its association with its donor, still exists. We see from these halachas that notwithstanding the fact that when a person donates something to a shul, it belongs to the shul. However, it seems that as long as it's still strongly associated with the donor retains certain rights, and these include the right to ensure the purpose it was donated for is maintained. Similarly, in our case, if the shul splits up, as long as the items which have been donated are still strongly associated with the donor or their family will receive it back so that it can be used in the Beis HaKnesses of their choice.
But why would the Ramah encourage that behavior? Because surely, although it's advantageous for the donor, it could lead to a lot of risk down the line if the donor carries that ownership of the item he gave and he'll want to pull back and it can affect a lot of people. Why did he encourage it? Surely it would lead to disputes.
The Ramah's not saying that the donor owns it Once you've given it to the stock of your choice, the shul of your choice, it's no longer yours. It belongs to the shul. However, there's a caveat that because you've given it for a specific purpose, if you keep your name on it, then you will have the ability to ensure it stays for the purpose which it was given for. Otherwise, after a period of time, the shul may have more flexibility in replacing it, in downgrading it. So it's more true to the wishes of the donor, which very often is something donors are looking for.
Right. And let's say donating a Sefer Torah l'il nishmas, would that be considered putting one's name on a Sefer Torah?
Sefer Torah, it's worth mentioning, normally if a person writes a Sefer Torah because they want to be mekayim, the mitzvah of ksiva Sefer Torah, you wouldn't normally donate it to a shul. You'd normally lend it to a shul. There are opinions that say if you donate it to a shul, then you haven't actually got your mitzvah and you'd have to go and write another Sefer Torah.
Now, that's purely in keeping with the mitzvah.
Keeping the mitzvah. In fact, there's a case locally where that happened. Someone donated it to a shul and then heard in a shir in the shul that actually, if you donate it, you haven't got your mitzvah, and he went out and had another Sefer Torah written, which he subsequently lent. In fact, most times when people lend a Sefer Torah to a shul, there'll be a document between them and the shul stating clearly who has to insure it and who actually owns it, etc. But in these tshuvas, we were talking about the community coming together and actually donating it to the shul, but nevertheless, there seems to be some kind of benefits that linger.
Maybe slightly off topic, but in this theme of donating to shuls, if someone donates to a shul an item, let's say, whether it's a bech or a menorah, and let's say it wasn't to the liking of the community, let's say it's an ugly piece of furniture, does the shul have a right, let's say it's an overseas donor, to sell that item and use the money for in any way they see fit without its knowledge?
No, that's quite a loaded question. In this particular halacha, again, a shul has a right to say, we'd rather not accept this gift and try diplomatically to get out of it. If they were to accept it and it was given with that specific intention, and especially as nowadays often there'll be a small plaque, that would seem to come under the halacha that we're talking about, which would have certain restrictions and limitations on what the shul could do afterwards.
Final question. Back in the day, I think there was more of a communal shul. I think nowadays things have changed. You can have five shuls in a single block. Have things changed in history regarding the community of the shul, whether it's responsibilities or even ownership? Has that changed in history, seeing that it's not so much, so to speak, the community-led, but rather a shul itself? Or just in general, has this halacha, have you seen a big change, or is this...
One of the things that's changed considerably, and this comes up often in Dinei Torah, is historically a shul, the Shulchan Aruch speaks about Zayin Tuvei Ho'eh, or you can have seven appointed people responsible for a kehillah, responsible for a shul, and they're the ones who make decisions. They're elected by the shul, make decisions on behalf of the shul. And Shulchan Aruch speaks about the leeway that they're given to make those decisions, sometimes quite drastically. One of the things that's happened over the years, especially we live in a country which has charities, a charity commission, trustees. And often you find that when a charity is created, because it's under the charity commission, certain rules and regulations required. And as such, you need to put down and nominate certain trustees. Very often there's little thought given as to who those trustees should be because they're just people who don't mind being trustees. In fact, as time has progressed, there's a lot of liability that comes with being a trustee. It's actually quite hard to get people who know what they're doing and are responsible to volunteer as being trustees. So sometimes the trustees may have been people randomly chosen from a community, from associated with a yeshiva, or associated, for that matter, with a chassidus. And then circumstances over time can change. Sometimes there can be a machlokes, a power struggle, a split. Sometimes it comes down to who are the holding trustees, because they may well be muhsik in the charity, the building, the trust. And sometimes there's a question of, well, really they're just holding it for the community, for the tzibur, so they should have to do whatever the majority of the tzibur tell them. But there can be situations where, seeing as they are the legal guardians of the shul, the legal owners of the shul on behalf of the shul, they're the apotropsim. that may bring them quite a bit more power than was actually necessarily intended at the time. So at the same time as one says and advises a person to get the right advice before becoming a trustee, and strongly advise a moisad, an organization, a community organization, to make sure when they choose their trustees, they choose them with care.
Rav Posen, thank you very much for coming in. Thank you for taking off your valuable time to share your insights with us. And please subscribe so you don't miss another episode. And for all questions, please email podcast@jle.org.uk. Thank you.